Hello, this is David Gordon Koch reporting for the NB Media Co-op from Moncton. Moncton is one of many places in the country where the cost of housing remains a major issue, although recent data from Statistics Canada shows some positive signs. The asking price to rent a two-bedroom apartment went down by 1.3% in the third quarter of 2025 in Metro Moncton compared to the same period the previous year, according to StatsCan. And we've actually seen rent go down in 24 of 40 census metropolitan areas during that time, including Toronto and Vancouver, the two least affordable markets in the country. However, if we compare to 2019, prices for housing have massively increased overall. In Metro Moncton, the average asking price for a two-bedroom apartment was $900 shortly before the pandemic, compared to $1,530 by the third quarter of 2025, an increase of 70%. For more on this issue, I'm speaking with Brian Doucette, a filmmaker and associate professor at the University of Waterloo's School of Planning. He recently launched a new feature-length documentary titled Thinking Beyond the Market, a film about genuinely affordable housing, and is screening it across the country. The New Brunswick premiere of this film is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Sunday, January 11th at the Moncton Public Library. The film is in English with French subtitles, and the event will also include a panel discussion featuring New Brunswick professors Matthew Hayes, Julia Woodhall Melnick, and Tobin LeBlanc-Haley, who is, full disclosure, a member of the NB Media Co-op's board of directors. So thanks for joining us today, Professor Brian Doucette.
My pleasure, David. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, to start off with, what was your original impetus for this project, and when did you start working on it?
So I've researched housing for a long time, for well over a decade. And when you're studying a topic like housing, which is very much a topic that extends beyond the realm of academia, I think it's really important to share that information, to share that research with wider audiences. You know, I go to conferences and I speak to other housing researchers, and there is disagreement about what needs to happen and about causes and so on. But there's a lot of consensus. There's a lot of agreement on many things. But those debates and discussions tend to stay within those fairly narrow confines. And for many years, I've oriented a lot of the research that I've done and the output that I've done in terms of writing and engagement with different audiences. I've oriented that towards the broader debates, and I call them the four P's. So you have your political debates, your policy debates, your planning debates, because I'm in urban planning, and importantly, your public debates or your public conversations. And I think as someone who studies a topic that is so relevant to all four of those, I think it really is essential to be contributing to those conversations, not starting new conversations, because as I said, they're already going on, but enhancing those existing conversations by bringing both my own research as well as broader knowledge and research about housing into those four conversations. I've done that for a long time, writing in the media, giving media interviews, writing research reports that are more publicly accessible. But really, the ultimate way to enhance those conversations and to get that information out there is to do something like a documentary film. And so I was very fortunate to team up with a couple of really good filmmakers and to get some funding from the Social Science and Humanities Research Council to actually go across Canada to make this film.
And with discussions happening like the one we're having a panel discussion here in Moncton on Sunday. And now, Professor Doucette, in a 2023 research paper that you co-authored, you write, housing is both a human right and a speculative commodity from which to extract wealth. Until we fully reconcile these contradictory roles that housing plays, we will be in a perpetual state of crisis. Can you elaborate on this contradiction, why it's so central to the problems that we're facing today?
Yeah, that's a great quote you pulled from that report, because I think that really informs a lot of the thinking about the film. And, you know, we have to imagine that housing has these dual roles within our society. So on the one hand, it's shelter and a basic human right. On the other hand, it is a source of wealth, a speculative commodity from which to make money. And one of the things I explain in the film very, very clearly and very sort of directly is it can't succeed at both, right? We cannot have a lucrative source of wealth for some and shelter for all. It just doesn't work. And what I do in the film, I don't say, you know, we need to get rid of the speculative side entirely, right? Because that's not going to happen. And the film is more about things that are happening rather than, you know, some distant utopian dream way out there in the future. And so I look for things that actively try to shift that pendulum, so to speak, right, between wealth on the one hand and shelter on the other, that try and shift that pendulum away from speculation towards housing as a human right. Mm-hmm. And it sort of comes full circle to the title of the film, Thinking Beyond the Market. It's not to say, you know, there's no role for the market in delivering housing. The vast majority of Canadians live in market-based housing. It's one of the main messages of the film is really to understand that there are limitations in terms of what the market is able to do to deliver outcomes that will address the housing crisis or the housing problem. And if we can acknowledge that, if we can acknowledge what those limitations are, and understand that there is a whole other range of options if we are able to think in terms of building new housing outside of the market, regulating new construction that we permit so that some of that market-driven housing is genuinely affordable. And also on the existing housing supply, we can preserve existing housing supply outside of the market entirely, and we can also come up with rules and policies to ensure that when the market is, for example, redeveloping existing housing, that those units are protected, and importantly, the people living in those units are protected. Mm. So all these things become possible when we understand that the market alone isn't going to solve this. And, you know, we've had 30 or 40 years in not just in Canada, but in countries around the world, of saying we will defer to the market to solve these problems. And it's clear that doesn't lead to the kind of outcomes we need if we want to have safe, secure, and affordable housing for all. So we do have to think beyond what the market can do, and we do have to be proactive at all levels of government, from different organizations, from different communities, and from individuals. And the film gives pathways as to how that can be possible.
Now, I want to talk about what one issue in particular with respect to housing affordability identified by researchers in New Brunswick. They found that low-rent housing, such as rooming houses, for example, are being demolished, and new construction is geared towards the high-end market. Retirees who are downsizing their homes, selling off homes in the very high-valued markets, and then buying a nice condo or kind of luxury rental apartment, renting a luxury rental apartment, this kind of thing. Can you talk about potential solutions to this kind of trap that communities seem to be falling into?
Yeah, absolutely, David. And, you know, I'll point out that this is not just a New Brunswick problem. I know you've got some fantastic housing researchers in New Brunswick who are doing great work. And, you know, it also shows that this is not just a big city problem either, right? These kind of things go on in Toronto, in Vancouver, in other global cities, but they also go on in communities up and down the urban hierarchy, urban and rural communities. And what you describe is something that, again, much of our mainstream approach to dealing with the housing crisis has been focused on numbers, right? We need new supply. We need more units. And yes, every housing researcher, I think, would agree that as our population rises, so too should our housing supply. But we really have to be thinking about, I think, two important questions. What kind of housing and for whom? That's the first one. And that's really important because we often really just look at numbers. So we really need to look at what, you know, who that housing is for that we're building. We also, really importantly, need to look at what is being lost when we redevelop. And if you think of the scenario you sketched, and let's just add some numbers to it, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say there's that old rooming house that you talked about, maybe has 10 units, that gets knocked down, and a new building, a denser building, a taller building goes up, and maybe it has 50 units or 100 units, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at that perspective from just the numbers, and especially if that's in an existing urban area, it's close to transit, it's mixed use, whatever, you know, that ticks so many of those planning boxes, mm-hmm. so of what we consider to be good planning, dealing with the housing crisis, adding supply. But when you delve deeper into what was lost and what's, you know, what's being built for whom, you realize it becomes a much more complicated issue. I had a research project here in Kitchener-Waterloo, where I live, that looked at our new light rail transit corridor, a 19-kilometer corridor, and the statistics, the data was basically saying, you know, there's no displacement going on, there's new housing, but it's you know, not displacing existing residents. We don't see any evidence of that in the numbers, right? And I looked at that, and I was working with some nonprofits based here locally, and we sort of, we scratched our head, and we're like, what is this report talking about? Of course we're losing rooming houses, we're losing that lower end of market, you know, housing that's getting either renovated or demolished. So it's a huge, huge problem. But it's one, like so many other issues when it comes to housing, where there are solutions that are already happening.
Well, so what's an example of what? Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so the best one, I think, in Canada, which we do feature in the film, is in mm-hmm. Burnaby, British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And Burnaby is a rapidly growing community. They don't have a whole lot of land for expansion. And they were seeing a lot of these two- or three-story walk-up apartments near SkyTrain stations being bought by developers, knocked down, lower income. These were the more affordable units in the community. Lower income residents just being kicked out onto the streets and mm-hmm. 30 or 40-story towers replacing them. So Burnaby did two things. They, first of all, had permission from the province of British Columbia to zone all of their existing rental properties, all of their existing rental areas as rental. Most places across Canada, you just zone, you're allowed to zone for residential. And then it's up to the developer or the property owner to decide if it's a condo, a rental, what have you. Hmm. Burnaby was given the power to zone for rental. So all the existing rental buildings are now zoned for rental. So if they get redeveloped, they have to be rental housing. Hmm. The other thing that they did is within that, include a 20% affordability requirement. So anybody that tells you anywhere across Canada, any developers say, you know, we just can't include any affordable housing in our units. We it doesn't work. Burnaby has shown in Canada that you can have 20% affordable requirements for new buildings, and construction in Burnaby has been booming ever since, both market and non-market. Hmm. They also have a number of measures to protect tenants. So if the tenant has to move because their building's being demolished, the developer has to provide either an alternate accommodation in the interim or provide a rental top-up if they end up paying more. They have to pay the moving cost not once but twice, right, to move out and to move back, and those tenants get a unit in the new building at roughly the same rent they were paying prior to the demolition. Hmm. This is not rocket science. These are the kind of things that proactive municipalities, proactive governments need to do if we're to ensure that A, existing housing is protected, like I talked about earlier, and B, that some of the new supply meets the demand that we have, right? Mm-hmm. We have this mismatch of the supply that we're getting in a lot of communities doesn't really match the demand that we need for shelter.
Mm-hmm. And now, here in New Brunswick, we often hear about the housing crisis in terms of supply and demand. Landlords often argue in this way that the provincial government should increase supply by getting rid of policies such as rent caps. There's a 3% annual limit currently in place in New Brunswick on rent increases, saying that it makes developers unwilling to invest in housing. How do you respond to this kind of analysis?
I mean, if you're talking about rent control, which is one of the most contentious issues in all of housing. And a lot of economists, a lot of more free market thinkers and advocates really don't like rent control. And I would respond with a couple of couple of ways. First of all, you know, some of the research that we've done that informs the film really focuses on how the lack of proper rent control, particularly when a unit is vacant, right? A vacancy decontrol or a tenant-based system of rent control. So most parts of the country, I think including New Brunswick, if the unit is empty, the landlord can raise the rent to whatever they want for the new tenant coming in.
That's right.
Well,
that's the case here. Yep.
That's the same in Ontario. It's one of the big loopholes that we have in our system of rent control. That creates a huge incentive for landlords to do anything that they can to evict long-term sitting tenants who are paying rent-controlled rates because they can make more money renting to new tenants. Mm-hmm. So it makes the lives of tenants miserable. And some of the research that we've done here in Waterloo and across Ontario has really illustrated that. So that's a big problem. The evidence in terms of the research internationally about the relationship between rent control and new construction is really quite inconclusive. There is no clear, yes, rent control leads to dramatically lower levels of construction. You know, another way to look at it is if you are a landlord and you want to make a certain amount of profit, if there are a bit of regulations on that profit, you have to have more units to make that same amount of money. So there is also an idea that it can help encourage more units to come online. The other thing I would add is that we regulate pretty much everything in our society. And we do it out of a public interest and a public interest for safety. So things like the child seats that you put your kids in your cars, the beer that you drink, the food that you eat, all of those regulations are designed to keep us safe. And they would, in theory, eat into the profits of the people producing them. Yet we think it's fine for a landlord to say, well, I'm just going to charge whatever I want for housing, which we have declared to be a human right. So I think we have to be a little more open to the idea that we do need regulations on rent if we want to have housing outcomes that mean that people can afford places to live. There are lots and lots of ways as well to stimulate rental construction through taxes, through financing, through all sorts of different measures that can stimulate the construction of new rental rental construction, rather than just relying on we're going to get rid of all regulations and let landlords charge whatever they want. I don't think that is going to get the best outcomes in terms of creating the kinds of communities and the kinds of housing that we actually want.
Now, that 2023 study that I referenced a moment ago, it noted that Prince Edward Island's policy is a rare example of a rent cap tied to the unit, not the renter. This goes back to what you were saying a moment ago, that in most jurisdictions in Canada, including New Brunswick, there's no limit on rent increases when the unit is vacant. Now, Now, critics here warn that this is a loophole that leads to rent evictions. Can you talk about this issue and the significance of PEI's policy?
So yeah, PEI is different, and it is one of the reasons we go there in the film. In fact, the main reason we go there in the film to learn about their unit-based system of rent control. And, you know, it's explained very clearly in the film by folks on PEI. And, you know, if you think of the logic, if you have a $1,000 apartment, that apartment should be $1,000 a month regardless of who's living in it, right? So there are very clear rules in PEI that regulate the rent increases. This is not, you know, I'm a big believer in rent control. And I think it is one of the simplest and best measures that can be done to protect tenants and to protect existing rental supply from becoming too expensive. But I'm also not in favor of freezing rents at deeply below market rates for an indefinite period of time. I don't think that is a productive way to have a housing system that we need and want. So a well-functioning rent control system regulates rents to permit rises each year because things become more expensive, right? So, but does it in a way that tries to ensure that tenants are not unduly burdened while also allowing that revenue or that income from rental properties to grow. And I think the big fundamental difference that a lot of people have, and definitely the difference between PEI and other parts of the country, is in PEI that rule applies whether or not the unit is empty or occupied. In other words, if you're renting an apartment for $1,000 a month, when if you leave and I rent it, in PEI, that's still going to be $1,000 or maybe $1,050 a month apartment. In most other parts of Canada, if you left that $1,000 a month apartment and I moved in, I might be paying $1,700, $1,800, $1,900. And we hear lots of stories in other communities. I'd done some work in Hamilton, Ontario, and have heard many stories of people who move into apartments and paying, you know, pretty close to double what the previous tenant was paying. And again, coming back to what I mentioned earlier, where do you think the incentive is going to be for the landlord to be very nasty to you as a tenant paying $1,000 when they know they can rent to me for $1,700? Your life is going to be pretty miserable as the landlord is going to get you out. And again, this is stuff that we don't have a whole lot of data about. Research that I've done here in Ontario, where we don't have this kind of rent control that PEI does, you know, we interviewed over 100 people who had been displaced in different communities across Ontario, and almost none of the stories that we collected would have showed up in any statistical database. Because what happens after all this harassment, this intimidation, the threats, the printed eviction notices, I mean, I can print off an eviction notice and hand it to a tenant. And for a lot of tenants, they think they have to leave, or they fear they might be made homeless. And so what happens is a lot of them just give up. They leave. And this data about this kind of stuff just doesn't exist. And so by rendering visible these experiences and the consequences of not having both good rent control and tenant protection, but also good enforcement. I think another really key thing from the film is any policy, whether it be Burnaby's, whether it be PEI's, whether it be whatever, any policy is only as good as the enforcement that you have to back it up.
Now, a lot of these ideas seem like common sense in some ways, but it seems that this free market orientation is incredibly influential in Canada with the political class. What do you think is stopping some of these ideas from gaining momentum more quickly? Or how powerful are real estate interests in this country?
I mean, it's a good line from the film, from PEI, where one of the people we're speaking to says, you know, who is going to represent the interests of tenants, of people who might be afraid to go to the authorities, especially when landlords have a hired lobbyist, right? The power balances are very, very uneven. And the relationship between landlord and tenant, and look, I'm not against all landlords, right? That's not the perspective that I'm coming from. I'm more in favor of having clear rules and regulations that everybody plays by to ensure we have a fair system. That relationship between landlord and tenants, I think we have to acknowledge, is one of the most unequal, if not the most unequal, that we have in our society. But yeah, we've had 30 or 40 years in this country, and it's not just this country, it's many other countries around the world, where we have deferred the kinds of solutions that are required to the market, right? And this is not just in housing, it's in things like healthcare and education and a whole host of other kind of broader policy challenges where the market is leading the way. And I think we've been so fixated as a society that we've sort of forgotten what the public sector can do. We've forgotten what the not-for-profit sector can do, often in partnership with other players. You know, we've come to this point as well where any kind of public intervention into housing has been so residualized, right? Mm-hmm. So that a teacher or a nurse or a bus driver couldn't imagine an idea that they could be living in some kind of non-market housing, because we just haven't had any of those kinds of solutions for generations. But then if you look at what's happening in communities all across the country, it's many of those teachers and nurses and bus drivers and even, you know, a lot of our planning graduates, when it comes to housing, they're struggling, right? Yeah. And they're moving further out, or they're living in much smaller places. And the idea that if we just did more of the same, that is going to solve everything, I think it's naive. Again, I'm not saying we don't need the market to be building housing. Again, they build the vast majority of housing in Canada and will for the foreseeable future. But I think we need to be much more ambitious and much more creative in terms of understanding what the limitations are of the market, and then being proactive to go beyond. So in Canada, we got some new numbers recently. The numbers we use in the film, which were the numbers that people had been quoting for a long time, was about 3.5% of Canada's housing stock was non-market, which is any kind of, it's a whole range of different housing options that are removed from market forces, which thereby guarantee affordability in perpetuity. So that could be your rent geared to income. That could be various kinds of ownership schemes like we focus on in Whistler, not-for-profit housing, all sorts of things. So 3.5%. Some new numbers have come up, said it's a little bit higher, but we're still talking under 5%. Well, I mean, Scotiabank in 2023, I think it was, and Scotiabank is hardly a bastion of socialist thought, came out with a report and said basically the scale of private sector construction, private market construction, that is going to be required to restore affordability to around 1990 levels is more than double the amount that we've ever done in any year, and we'll have to sustain that for many, many years. And their conclusion was that's just not feasible. So what they recommended is that we actually work towards doubling the percentage of non-market housing in this country. So if we did that and we brought it up to 7% of our housing stock, we would only be at the OECD average, right? Mm. We'd only be at the average of our peer countries. And so there is a lot of scope to do things differently. It does require a different mindset. It requires, as I said, understanding the limitations of what the market can do, acknowledging that the market's going to build and we need the market to build. Yes, that's true. But we need to do more. And we need to think differently about some of the resources and some of the assets that we collectively own. So one of the things that comes up a lot in the film is publicly owned land. And again, coming back to your question of, you know, why don't we do things differently? You know, we've had a policies, and sometimes it's written in very, very specifically that, you know, any surplus government land is sold to the highest bidder on the open market. And that's an approach, and that will deliver some housing, kind of like what you discussed earlier in terms of higher end housing, right? It will deliver units, but it won't deliver the kind of outcomes that we really need. And again, understanding that the market isn't going to get us out of this, we really have to think about, well, what levers can we pull that don't involve the market developers or market forces being front and center, and using public land, whether it be federal land, whether it be provincially owned land, whether it be municipally owned land or what have you, school board land, you name it, using that to deliver fundamentally different outcomes, I think is one of the key pathways to getting different kind of housing supply that we're not getting. Hmm.
Hmm. Now, in addition to homelessness, one very troubling aspect of the housing crisis is how migrants and immigrants have been vilified for population increases linked to higher housing costs. Can you comment briefly, and do you believe that better housing policy with better market interventions in the housing market could help prevent the kind of racist backlash and scapegoating of immigrants and migrants that we've seen in recent years?
Yeah, and you know, let me start answering that question by maybe giving a bit of a longer term perspective, right? We are talking about housing today because it's become a very big issue, right? But it's become a very big issue for some people quite recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to give a little bit of a Toronto example. It's where I was born and raised, and I know the city very well. So if you go back 10 or 15 years, if you were a young professional couple, you were a lawyer or a planner or a journalist or a policymaker, right? The people who make shape and write about cities, you probably couldn't afford your prime location in Toronto. And I'm going to use the Danforth in the east end of the city. There's a subway line along there. And, you know, some of the stops at the start of the Danforth, Broadway Broadview or Chester, probably already too expensive. But you could go four or five subway stops further out, and you could have any number of houses in neighborhoods that you could afford and neighborhoods that you could help shape. Hmm. Now, the situation has become so extreme that even young lawyers, even young doctors, even young planners, you know, people who are making good money are struggling to afford shelter in places where they need and want to live. Mm-hmm. And so it has become a middle-class problem. And I think a lot of the solutions that are being put forward are very much middle-class solutions around things like changing zoning, right? Allowing triplexes on single-family zoning sites, right? Getting rid of the single-family zoning. And I'm all for that. I think that's, if there was ever a time when single family zoning had a purpose, it no longer does now. So I think we should just be able to build three or four units, five units, whatever, on any residential plot of land. I think that's fine. But I also don't think that is going to solve the problem for everybody. So that might make people who are priced out of the detached house or the semi-detached house, it might give them some more options. But it's going to do very little for people who've been struggling with housing for a long time. And this is quite a circuitous way to get to your question. But I think we have to be honest about why we're talking about housing now. We're not talking about housing today because of some newfound concern for the poor. Because if you speak to lower income folks, you speak to renters, you speak to people on social housing waiting lists, they will tell you we have been in a housing crisis for decades. But the people who matter politically now, the people who vote statistically more than those who don't, the people, as I said, who make and shape and write about cities, people, millions of people across the country who never would have dreamed that they'd be victims of a housing crisis are now struggling to afford shelter. Mm-hmm. But this is not a new issue. Mm-hmm. Have things got worse since the pandemic? Yes, but a lot of things have got worse. A lot of things have got more expensive. We need to have a longer term perspective. And if we are serious about dealing with housing, we also need to bring in perspectives of people who are rarely central to debates. And those would be lower income folks. Those would be new Canadians. Those would be tenants. Because their insights and their perspectives, as some of the work that I have done can illustrate and featured in the report that you cited earlier in our conversation, they will be very quick to tell you this is not a recent issue. And this is something that is far more complicated than a spike in immigration, far more complicated than, you know, blips in demographic changes.
Right. And one thing off camera before we started this interview a moment ago, you mentioned that people have seen housing prices also go up at times when, I think you said, when immigration is not increasing, correct? Or when populations are not increasing. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, you can have places that are not growing still have people struggling to afford shelter. Right? Again, population increase is one factor. But there's been very good research in cities like Detroit and Milwaukee and other places of particularly lower income folks who face rent evictions, who face displacement, who get evicted in communities where the population is not growing. It's not just a one-to-one of housing of population growth and house prices. It is far more complicated than that. right? And within that whole discussion, I said a lot of things become more difficult since the pandemic. I mean, we had interest rates that were slashed to next to nothing, which meant the cost of borrowing money went right down, which meant people borrowed money to buy houses, which drove up the prices of houses. So there's a lot of other factors that are in play. Are there things that can be done that ensure that when we're having population growth, we have good levels of adequate levels of housing? Absolutely, right? I've been an international student twice. I was an international student 1 year in Scotland, and I was an international student in the Netherlands. And those universities provided housing for me when I arrived. Not for the entire duration, but at least a start. And I think, you know, that would be a good approach, that if we are going to have international students coming to different universities and different institutions, that those institutions also play a role in providing the housing for their students, international or domestic. I think that's really important. The good news is lots of universities like mine have lots and lots of surplus land, which today is surface parking lots, that can be the greatest spots in all communities for non-market housing that can house the populations they need to house. I walk past, or I ride, when I ride my bike up to campus, I ride past a sea of surface parking lots. If I'm walking up from the light rail line, I walk right through a parking lot. My university is turning some of that into housing, but I think those are the kind of solutions when we talk about things like students coming to our universities. I think we need to make sure that they have places that they can live when they arrive, and that should be something that, that those institutions really pay attention to. But also those parking lots, you know, I wrote a paper last year in a planning magazine about turning publicly owned parking lots into non-market housing. This is not rocket science. This is not, you know, this is one of the most no-brainer ideas to really deliver the kind of housing that communities need. And, you know, your listeners or your viewers, look at when you're going around your own communities, look at the amount of parking that's probably owned by your municipalities or owned publicly, and envision what that could be in terms of housing.
Anything to add before we wrap up, Professor Doucette?
You know, my goal is to leave people with the idea that maybe the solutions to the housing crisis are already happening, but maybe they're hidden in plain sight. And I hope this film helps to render those solutions visible and inject them into those very important conversations that are going on from coast to coast to coast.
Great. Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Brian Doucette, filmmaker and associate professor at the University of Waterloo's School of Planning. The New Brunswick premiere of his new film, Thinking Beyond the Market, is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Sunday, January 11th at the Moncton Public Library. Professor Doucette will be in Toronto, but there'll be a panel of housing researchers from the University of New Brunswick here in Moncton for that event. For more details and to register, you can go to housingfilm.ca or our online publication, nbmediacoop.org. Again, Professor Brian Doucette, thanks for joining the NB Media Co-op today.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me on the show.